We're talking now with Rayanne Pilgrim. She's an associate professor of sociology at the University of Idaho and author of a new book titled Pushed Out: Contested Development and Rural Gentrification in the U.S. West. Rayanne, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And here's another key biographical note. Rayanne, you grew up in Dover, and this book is a sociological study of development that's taken place there and changed it from a former mill town to one with a split personality that you call Old Dover and New Dover. More than that, the book is also an examination of Dover's experience as a case study for the, quote, let's say, a rural gentrification that is happening in many small towns around the Western U.S., where residents of small communities that were once based on agriculture or timber or mining are changing with an influx of so-called amenity migrants. That is, new residents are moving to these small communities for values of rural communities. So the book is both dealing with the big trend, but it's also intensely personal for you as someone who grew up in Dover. And let's start there. Tell us the when and why of growing up in Dover.
Well, I don't know. I feel bad saying I grew up there, but I moved there when I was a freshman in high school. So I went lived there all through high school, and now my mom's been in Sandpoint now for the last 25 years, which I guess I'm aging myself a bit. But we moved there after having moved around Montana, which is my home state, a lot, and we found kind of a home right on Chuck Slough. My mom was a newly single mom with two little kids, and I guess I was so little, and I ended up riding the Dover school bus. And so, I think just proximity, and I also just think like one of my dearest friends in high school and through college was from Dover, and I think just felt very connected to the people there because I spent a lot of time on the school bus. I was the last person off every day. And so I just had a lot of friends there. My high school boyfriend, his mom was in Dover, so I spent a lot of time out there, and it felt as much like home as any place after we had left Montana felt like. It felt familiar. People were kind and warm, and I just really liked how it felt.
And what years, what did you mention that?
No, I think it would have been like on like 95 through 99 that. And then I left for college.
Well, let's talk about that. You pursued a career in sociology. How did you get interested in that?
That's a really good question. When I went to college, I either wanted to be a chemistry major or a journalism major, probably because I had two wonderful teachers and, well, many wonderful teachers at Sandpoint High, but I really loved chemistry and journalism. And I think it's sociology is this wonderful discipline that brings together so many different pieces of the human experience, and I think that's what was really fun about writing this book too, was I get to look at political systems, economic systems, environmental systems. So sociology, I'm kind of a global thinker. I like knowing everything. I always want to understand everything. I'm always trying to add more context, make things more complex. And I think sociology, just when I found sociology, and I didn't find it till I think like almost my junior year of college, and I didn't have a major yet, it was like, oh, this lets me do all the things that I'm interested in. Maybe with the exception of writing in a way that I enjoy writing, which is, I think, tries to be deeply accessible. And I've written a lot of academic articles with a lot of jargon that I didn't particularly like. And I think writing this book allowed me to kind of tap back into that journalism and the writing that I had loved so much.
Okay, let's get on to the book. You have some provocative ideas here. At least they will be provocative for some readers, or listeners, I should say. You cite a particular theory posed by a British urban geographer named David Harvey, who has written and formulated theories on what's called Marxist geography. The theory you frame your book around is called the spatial fix. Can you describe what the spatial fix is?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's, I'm not sure. I think it's provocative in the sense that, anytime that Marx's name is mentioned, things sound provocative. But I've had a lot of people who read the book, and nobody has found the argument that provocative, which I think is kind of interesting. I think it speaks to the way that Harvey's description of the spatial fix is pretty applicable. So the spatial fix is an idea
that tries to help people understand where does capitalism originate from and how do people create wealth in capitalism. So he's drawing from this idea that if people are living in rural places often, and those communities are pretty self-sufficient, that it's going to be hard to get to convince people to go work for somebody else. Right, and so he's drawing from some really foundational ideas from Marx, which is basically that capitalism comes from somewhere, and it comes from the idea that we close off the commons. Marx talks a lot about the enclosure laws in England and how do we get people, you know, in rural kind of self-sustaining communities to move into the city and work in factories where there's like sewage flowing down the streets, right? These are pretty dismal conditions. So how do you do that? And so Harvey's playing with this idea that you have to create a space for capitalism. And in the American West, particularly in North Idaho, that starts with the railroads. So the railroads come through the American West and they're given huge tracts of land by the U.S. government for the service of creating the railroad. But then the railroads need people to ship their goods to make their to make money, right? So we're creating the space for capitalism. We create the railroads, the timber industry, the agricultural industry, the mining industry. Those are all shipped on the railroads. And then you need people in those spaces to do that labor. So that's how we think about the spatial fixes. I think of it as having kind of three components. The first is creating a space for capitalism. And the second is, and this is the part that was really counterintuitive to me when I was doing my research in Dover, and I hadn't found Harvey when I started this research. I had just the story of Dover that, you know, I was giving timelines and trying to make sense of it. And one of the most interesting or compelling or sad things to me in the story of Dover is the infrastructural decline. So when I had friends in Dover, they had talked about the boil order that Dover had been under. And so that was a boil order that lasted for 6 years. When I was a kid, I had no idea that it had lasted that long. And not only was the city under a boil order for 6 years, there were often pretty large periods of time where there was actually no water to the city of Dover because their pump would fail. Then they were under, their sewer system was red tagged. And so, you know, what was interesting about that part of the story? Why did it drive kind of development? And that was the thing that really I couldn't make sense of, right? We had this like kind of flourishing this community, this period of decline, and then this flourishing again. And I was trying to make sense of these sort of three periods. And so Harvey argues actually that decline is essential to creating new opportunities for wealthy people to become wealthier. That if you can create decline in a space, it devalues it and allows people with capital to move back into that space and create and extract more value from it. And so when I was trying to understand what was happening in Dover and I ran into Harvey's theory, I knew a lot about the enclosure laws. I teach about agriculture, so I think a lot about, you know, how does agricultural systems, how do they work? So I knew a lot about that sort of first element and teach a lot about the enclosure laws. But the second two I hadn't. And so in Dover, we see this intense infrastructural decline. It really devalues the price of the land, the price of people's homes. They literally can't sell their homes because they're, you don't have running water to them, which is kind of an essential element of selling a house. And so, of course, once they shored up all those issues, so the city of Dover rebuilt their water system, they rebuilt their sewer system, both through grants for low-income communities, then that made that land more valuable. I also argue in the book and that from a theoretical standpoint, the way we have talked about extractive industries like logging, particularly kind of the environmental movement, the kind of the left talks about it like it's going to destroy things, right? And capitalism is driven by that model of scarcity or the idea that there are scarce resources. So by making the West seem like a scarce resource, it actually made it all the more valuable too. So it's kind of those two ideas of how do we recreate wealth after we kind of devalue a space. So that's how I use Harvey. And
this kind of describes a boom-bust cycle for rural Western towns, would you say? I think you call it boom-town versus bypass town in the book.
Yeah, so booming versus bypass West.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of dovetails with the idea of this spatial fix in these mm-hmm. these periods of time that these rural towns that would have been based on extractive industries are kind of going through.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a provocative idea, but I also think it's provocative in theory, but I haven't had anyone read it yet and be like, no, you don't understand how this works, or that's not an accurate description of, you know. So I think it's, I don't think of it actually as that provocative. I think it's pretty, like, it's a pretty effective explanatory system for the data that I had.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the spatial fix and this cycle is kind of a big theory that you're exploring with Dover as basically a case study. Let's talk a little bit about the methodology for writing the book. You use pseudonyms for the individuals, mm-hmm. as well as for the Dover Bay development itself, which you call Milltown in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us why that is.
I mean, it's sort of, I think there's two kind of competing reasons for it. So when I did my interviews, I had considered, I kind of planned on naming people. A lot of people wanted, you know, they were excited to have their story told. It's pretty, I can't think of maybe any sociological stories or studies or papers where respondents are named. It's a pretty non-standard practice. And so when my book had to go through two cycles of peer review, and my reviewers, one in particular, just kind of said that she couldn't or they couldn't go forward with a book that names respondents without a really, really compelling reason as to why it's important to the sociology of it. And I just felt like I didn't really have that compelling argument. And in part because some people were very clear that they did not want to be identified in the book. And so, you know, I have to go through an IRB process, institutional review board, to make sure my research is ethical. And, you know, in my informed consent forms that I gave everyone, they could decide if they wanted to be named or not named. I kind of planned on naming some people. But it became really complicated to try and figure out, well, how am I going to name this person and not this person when they have, like, a relationship in the story, right? So I can't name one person who's then, like, in a meeting with this other person and not be named. And, yeah, like, trying to figure out how I could do that ethically just became it seemed impossible. And I think the other reason, like, to give things pseudonyms, like the development of things, is that this is not, I mean, I think when we're people who are from Sandpoint or in Dover or North Idaho, this is a very specific story and it feels very personal, but it's also a case study. And I'm hoping that, you know, this will be a book that people teach in North Carolina and that people who are in New Mexico can pick up and they can see their own communities and try and make sense of what they're seeing around them. And in that case, you know, I didn't want the specifics of the story to get into the way of the very kind of general argument I'm trying to make, too. So I think, you know, for people who are in the local community, it feels kind of maybe, I don't know, disorienting or something to have pseudonyms. But I think, you know, both from within my discipline and then kind of more broadly, if you're making a case study and trying to make it general, it's become sort of necessary, I think, to provide those.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you've already described some of the feeling infrastructure problems Dover faced, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit more. But I want to take a step back from that because the book provides basically a blow-by-blow account of the history of Dover from the time it was part of the indigenous lands of the Kalispell tribe up to its birth as a sawmill town. So, you know, where did Dover come from?
I think that chapter is called, like, A Brief History of the Last 62 Million Years or something.
Yeah, you actually go back deeper than the indigenous time, yeah.
And so, I mean, I don't even know where to start. Where did Dover come from? I mean, like, it came because a railroad was laid. And there was huge tracts of timber to be cleared. But, you know, those existed because indigenous people had lived on this land. It depends who you ask, right? Somewhere between time immemorial and the last, like, 12 million or 12,000 years. And those lands were cared for and nourished and you know, protected in particular ways. And that's why those forests looked like they did when the railroad came through. There was a high demand for timber, both to build the railroad and on the East Coast. So in some ways, you know, the West becomes this kind of satellite state for the East Coast to be able to extract resources out of and send to the East Coast. It's a story about immigration and like westward expansion. I don't know. I feel like the story of America, you can kind of, if you look closely at any place, you can tell the whole story of the universe in like a particular place. And I think Dover tells the story that almost any community could tell if you looked carefully enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then the town, you know, kind of became a mill town when there was a fire at a another sawmill down the
mm-hmm.
river from them.
Yeah, there was a fire in Laclede.
Yeah. What year was that?
Oh, gosh. I want to say it was 1921, but don't quote me on that.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it was 1921.
We'll have to look
it
up in the book, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, read the book.
And what happened was they actually, after that sawmill, you know, burned up, they actually floated big chunks of it, the community there, up the river.
Yep, right up the river. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's that became Dover.
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating, I mean, just so many elements of it. Yep, so they floated the community hall, a lot of the little houses kind of across from the community hall, and the church all up the river from Laclede and moved them to Dover. And then the mill ran, and actually the mill in Dover were kind of on again, off again. I think A.C. White moved it up, and then it closed down during the Depression. It stayed closed for quite some time and then came back, I think, about in the 1940s, and then was retooled quite a few times. I think they made, like, wood paneling for walls at some point. And mm-hmm. so it went through, like, a lot of different iterations, like many things, right? There was a lot of retooling and trying to keep up with kind of the changing timber economy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the book gets into a very detailed account of the events that led up to the approval of the development. And you describe part of the genesis of that, I think, was the fact that the infrastructure was failing. The water system, the owner of the property where the sawmill was had maintained the water system for the community to use, and of course the community was made up of the workers at the sawmill.
Mm-hmm.
And then the legacy of that, though, was that at one point the owner of that sawmill property just said, "Okay, we're out of here now, and the
yep.
water system is over to you guys."
Yeah, they sold the mill land, and the community of Dover received letters from the new owners that said, "By the way, we've purchased the mill site," and this is I'm so grateful to have this letter from the archives, but it said the purchase of water was, quote, incidental to the purchase of the land. And so we're going to be shutting off your water.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, this was in the 70s, the late 70s, I think. The community just scrambled to try and figure out what they were going to do. And there was, no, I could never find out if this was true or not, but the understanding was that if once an entity provided water, they were legally required to continue to provide that water as long as the community paid their bills. And so it's amazing. Like, when I was interviewing people from Dover about this, some of them could pull out their canceled checks that they had sent in the 70s to prove that they were paying for their water because they were so afraid that the water was going to get turned off. But, well, it wasn't turned off. The new owners refused to upgrade the system in any way. So they were left with a water system that had been built in the 1920s that had wooden pipes, for one thing, and a failing pump. I mean, it was just, I think, in an engineering firm they brought in to look at their water system said it was akin to something you would see in a third world country. So it was just a really, really leaky system, and it wasn't cleaning the water, and the pump house would often, if there was like the power go out, the pump would die, then the pump house would flood, and so they'd have to bail like 7 feet of water to restart the pump. And these were like the city council, well, at the time it wasn't even a city, the community of Dover had to incorporate in order to get grants for communities to build their infrastructure. So because it hadn't actually been an incorporated community, they couldn't even get those grants for a while. They finally got grants to rebuild their water system, and then their sewer system was red tagged. So they had to get grants to rebuild their sewer system. And that's, I mean, it was a very, like, explicit kind of setup in Dover where the city of Dover was, they were trying to find land to build that sewer system on. And they needed, I think, about 13 acres. The mill site's about 300 acres. And they tried to use eminent domain to take that land and pay the market value, which at the time was, I think, about $80,000. And the mill owner, the developer who bought the land, refused to sell them that land at that price. And basically, they ended up in a court battle. And the judge decided that they had to rezone the land, the mill site, from agricultural and industrial to planned use development in order to get the land to buy the, or to put the sewer system on. So that part to me was just so, I don't know, surprising. I had spent so many months or years of my life trying to figure out how this happened, and then just to find this newspaper article, it's like, well, here's how it happened. It just was shocking to me that it was just so explicit. You know, I'd expected to, I'd done so many interviews and nobody had just told me. I think because it had happened and then that land didn't get developed for a long time and it was went to a couple different owners before it actually got developed, I think there was kind of a collective amnesia about that court case, or people didn't want to talk about it. I'm not quite sure why nobody told me, here's this like very specific thing that happened that caused this to happen.
Well, another part of the book, you describe the common areas that the mill owners at one time let the community use. There was a baseball diamond, and there was a sandy beach, as well as what you call the bluff. It's that big granite knob. I think the locals called it Tank Hill, at least I did back in the 80s. Because they had a, I think it was the water tank was up there.
That was their water tank, yep.
Yeah, yeah, up on that, up on top of that big granite knob. But this was all areas that the community used. You know, I mean, it was their swimming area. And that was as the land was being proposed for development, that was an issue for the locals.
Yes.
Loss of use of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's any more that you want to expand on there.
I mean, I just think it was one of the things that drove the, so in a lot of ways, the book started with a really basic question. I thought Dover is an interesting case study because it's a little bit different than some communities in the sense that the local city council, theoretically, at least when I went in, this was my question, why would they rezone? Right? Why would they give up that beach? Why would they give up the bluff? Right? Why rezone? Why not keep it agricultural? And so that was the question that drove the book, because I knew that sense of loss, particularly around the beach. And that was something that came up in every interview I did, just a lot of kind of heartbreak when you would talk to old timers about the loss of the beach. So why rezone? You know, the story of the book is trying to answer that question. I mean, I think it's, you know, the spatial fix, all those things are interesting in the book, but it's really just, in my mind, it was designed to answer this question I'd had kind of since I left Dover, like, why would they rezone it? And it was propelled in a lot of ways by the loss of those spaces, because they were, interestingly, I think they were spaces that were important to the Kalispell people. They were certainly important to the people of Dover. You know, why give those up? And so that's sort of one of the driving questions of the book.
And you note in the book that even the old timers, there were some that were opposed to a big development being built on that old mill land. But there were others, locals that were from the old Dover, who were in favor of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was not the story. And this is what I think good research does. I don't know if I knew what I didn't know what the story was. I had that question. I was really interested in it. I thought, I knew there'd been some really intense pushback against development. And I had assumed that I knew who those people would be and what their stories were going to be. And then I interviewed like 30 people for the book. And it was much more nuanced, and like all things are, right, when you start actually getting into them, than I had imagined it would be. And, I mean, I think, you know, the loss of the beach was really upsetting for everybody. I didn't interview a single person who was from Dover who didn't find that to be kind of a heartbreaking part of the development. But a lot of people, especially in the beginning, had thought that that Dover needed something, or it was not going to stay on the map. It needed to change in some ways. And there was, you know, people who were ready for that change. And I think, you know, one of the things that when I interviewed people, that even people who had been kind of opposed to development thought it was well done. I think they really appreciated that it had a lot of open public spaces. And it was interesting, like, depending on who you talk to, where those public spaces came from. I mean, I think a lot of the people who were involved in that decision-making felt like their pressure had helped create those open spaces. And then when you would talk to people closer to the development, they, you know, argued like, oh yeah, that had always been part of the design. So I think a lot of this was just kind of how things get lost when we have, you know, I think procedural kind of judicial type proceedings, like people's ability to communicate clearly with each other becomes really difficult.
Mm-hmm. So as I read the book, it felt like overall, you know, it's an indictment of the development that's occurred there because of the change that it wrought for the community members had lived in Dover sometime for generations. But you also mentioned there are positives to the development. How would you describe the Dover Bay development as its overall net effect on Dover?
Gosh, that's a really, I don't know. I think that that's a hard question for me to answer without like saying like, well, which position do you want me to put myself in? Like the old timer who was looking for change in the community, or one of the people who was like really opposed to development, or one of the developers, you know, like I think one of the things I was trying to do in the book is try and help people see each other's perspective. But I think giving a really clear perspective, this is what it was like for the people who experienced that change, because I think that's the story that most often fails to be told. So that's, I thought one of the things I found really refreshing about Dover Bay was that there's a lot of different price points, right? There's a lot of different ways of being part of that community. And you don't see that in a lot of places. There's a lot of open public spaces, which you don't see in a lot of those kind of communities. There's a community beach that was a public beach that is available with a city hall, right? There was a lot of infrastructure that was put in for the city of Dover. And I think those are both net positives, and I think probably good examples of like a kind of relationship between these two entities. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are miles of nice trails. I like to ride my bike out to Dover Bay and ride around the trails and enjoy the restaurant. So there are things all of the community can share there that I think most everybody would say, oh, this is nice. One issue that came up when the development was being proposed, and I remember it because I was around myself in those days, was that, oh, you know, if you take a look at what can happen on that property, what could very well have happened was a gated community could have been constructed.
Yep.
There. And that was I think, a big factor for a lot of people, that they looked at the proposal from the Dover Bay ownership and said, well, you know, it's a local guy that's going to develop this, and he does have heart for his community. He's saying it's going to stay open to the community to come in there. And, you know, how big of a role do you think that played in the approval of the rezone that was required there?
I mean, I think it played a pretty pivotal, huge role. I think one of the things that was frustrating for me was that I heard that story over and over again, that they, that the first proposal was a gated community, a golf course maybe even, that was going to come in. I heard that over and over from people I interviewed, but I never found any of the proposals. Like, they just didn't end up in the record. So I could never tell, like, was that a real fear? I mean, it was a real fear. Was that actually like something that was possible, or was that like, I don't know, just something to kind of rile up the community? I mean, one of the things I think that's important to recognize is that the timeline on this, like, a lot of that rezoning happened in the mid-90s. And that thing was built in Dover until really like the mid-2000s. So there was a 10-year period where there wasn't much happening. And I think that's where like that kind of collective confusion and amnesia came from, was like, yeah, these are not even the developer who bought the land and then tried to shut off the water. Like, that was happening 20 years before, you know, the development happened. So it's important not to kind of conflate all these different parts of the history with it. And, you know, I try to make it really clear in the book, the different actors and kind of timelines. But I think it was super, super important to the city council that they felt like they were going to preserve parts of their community that were really important to them. And they were able to work with somebody who was local to do that. And I think, you know, one of the things I try and talk about in the book is the conflict within the community of Dover when the development was proposed. You know, there were some people who took a very hard line that it should not be developed at all, and other people who believed that some kind of development needed to happen. And I think the main difference between those was people who were against it were using a pretty environmentally organized framework, and the people who were for it were using a more community-minded framework about what this. And the developer certainly, I think, saw the importance of the idea of community to Dover and helped to kind of imagine a development that could center that by providing community spaces, by providing a community hall, the trails, the park. You know, there's a lot of those pieces. And I think the idea that, you know, what's going to come through next, is it going to be a gated community? Is it going to be, you know, what can we live with? And this was something that I think they decided they could live with.
Mm-hmm. It's apparent when you read the book that you dug through hundreds of historical documents and news stories and city and county records, and you interviewed dozens of Dover residents, some of them going back to some of the really old families, as well as some mm-hmm. of the new arrivals. But I didn't see anywhere in the book where you cited an interview with the current ownership of Dover Bay. Did you reach out to them?
I am, because of my professional standards, I can't talk about who I did and didn't interview in the book.
Okay. We'll leave that at a maybe. Who knows? So the book just came out in May. Who would you say you wrote it for? What's the audience for the book?
You know, I tried to write an academic book that anybody I interviewed would want to pick up and read and find compelling. So I think the audience for the book, there's a lot of different audiences, obviously, you know, students and academic type audiences. But I also, one of my goals as a researcher is to be able to take the familiar and try and explain it in a way that offers insights to people who are living that, and they can say, oh yeah, that makes sense, and now I understand my world a little bit better. And so I would like to think that anybody who's watching their community change and trying to make sense of it would get something of value out of this book.
Mm-hmm. What kind of feedback have you gotten from, say, Dover locals?
I've gotten really, really wonderful feedback, really positive feedback. I've had people who said it was really validating, that it had felt like a really overwhelming experience to watch their community change. And then when they remembered everything they had been through, and I've gotten really positive feedback. So that has probably been the best thing that's ever happened to me in my career, is to like have people, you write this story, you hope you're doing it justice, and then to hear from them that you told their story well, it felt really, really good.
You know, there's a pretty distinct line of when you come into Dover and then when you enter the Dover Bay development between the old town and the new town, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see a way that old Dover and new Dover meld in the future? Are there models for this out there in other communities?
That's such a good question. So that's maybe the book I want to write next. So I'm always telling people, if you're hearing this interview and you have a good community example, you know, that's one of the chapters in the book, one of the things I try and do in every chapter is like take a story from that community and use that story to try and explain more what's happening. And I think the story of the two parts of the community trying to come together is really the story of the Dover summer picnic and just, you know, the few times they tried to do it with
the
whole community. It didn't work very well. And I think if you don't design communities with the idea of like, how are these two different places going to interface? How are they going to find commonality? I think it's a planning question. And I don't think that was necessarily the question that drove the development in Dover. Like, well, how do we make sure that the people in Old Dover feel connected to the development? I don't think that was a question that drove the development. And so I think I don't think it's an easy thing to overcome. And in part, like the way you can even just look at the way the communities are designed, they're not really designed to face each other.
Yeah.
They're not designed even like when we think about where the beach is, it's not super accessible for the people of Old Dover in the way that the old beach was, right? It's probably about a mile, right? So, you know, like thinking about like, how are we going to use those spaces? Who's going to be using them? What places? So we talk in planning, and I'm not a planner, but I know a little bit about planning, right? Like we think about like, what are spaces where people are going to interact? They're going to they're going to sit together. They're going to look at the water together. They're going to like create these moments of shared identity together. And I'm not really sure that the two communities are designed to do that, or like the community and the two different kind of spaces are designed to do that very effectively.
Mm-hmm. Well, we only have a minute or so left. I'm going to read something from your concluding chapter and then see if you can embellish on that just a little bit. In your last chapter, you write, quote, "It is worth asking if rural communities should accept this as normal. Perhaps development should serve communities, not the other way around." So what could development look like in the rural West when you place the dignity of people's lives and the autonomy of local communities at the center of the conversation? So that kind of goes to the core of the big question that the book poses. And you want to build on that a little bit for our last little dab of time?
Yeah, I guess, you know, we have one of the things I think sociology does is allows us like this mental space or this ability to step back and think like, well, what if things were different? So I think in a lot of ways people ask me like, well, what laws should be passed? Like, or, you know, what should we do? And I think in a lot of ways these are conceptual problems. And I keep thinking like, you know, like everybody more or less, you know, followed the rules when this development happened. And, you know, a developer came in, he had a thoughtful plan and he proposed it to the city council and it passed. But I think I keep thinking about people who work in the service industry. You know, I know there's like a big problem in Sandpoint trying to find enough restaurant workers and the price of housing. And, you know, what would rural communities look like if we asked people who were struggling to find housing to come and put together a plan for what they would like their housing to look like? You know, what if we recentered who got to be at those tables and design what we want our communities to look like? How would they look different? And I think we need to sort of step back and think, why don't we do it that way? You know, why do we accept housing prices to kind of fluctuate the way they do? Why do we, you know, I don't know if some people have been following the story in like Sun Valley, they're considering building tent cities to house service workers. When did that become an acceptable model for our communities? And I think those kind of questions I would like to see driving our conversations more and thinking about like, well, okay, let's center human experience, human dignity, workers' dignity in these conversations. What do our communities look like when we do that?
Well, Ryan, Pilgrim. Thank you so much for talking with us today. Again, your new book is Pushed Out, Contested Development and Rural Gentrification in the U.S. West. I got to say, it's a fascinating read, and I say that because I was here for much of the last part of that book, and it's an interesting history. It's an interesting sociological study, and it raises some big questions that apply to a lot of places around the West. So kudos on producing this book, Ryan, and thanks again so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.